So just to quickly reiterate what we covered this morning, I know it wasn't that long ago, but really what I wanted to cover in that first lecture is really the, I think in many ways, compelling evidence we have for dark matter. Hopefully you got some sense that actually in many cases these pieces of evidence are slightly dirtier than maybe somewhat they're presented, but nonetheless they do come together to tell us that we really have dark matter. But the part that I left off and what I want to come to now is just to say a few words about how the CMB is an extremely powerful probe of the fact that the total matter budget we have in the universe is not baryonic. Now, as I already mentioned at the outset, I really don't feel I can do justice for this in the 10 minutes I want to dedicate to this part of the talk, but I'd be very happy to answer questions or talk more about this offline. So let me just wrap up this final piece of evidence we have for dark matter before I turn to what I really want to focus on in this lecture, which is if we take seriously the idea that dark matter is a particle, what do we know about the properties that that particle could have? So you've probably all read the book, but let me give you my own spin on the brief history of time. And I'm going to be measuring this in two quantities. The first of these is redshift. And then what is the temperature of the background radiation, or I mean in the present day the CMB temperature as we're moving through these different epochs in time. So firstly, let's start out at the present epoch where the redshift is zero and the CMB has a temperature of about 0.2 milliEV. So what evidence do we have here of what's going on in the universe? Well, lots of things. For example, this is roughly where we're measuring rotation curves. And it's also the appropriate redshift if you're describing these tricep lectures, for instance, right? Then if we go slightly further back, I mean, I know I mentioned that this was an enormously distant object, but in converting distance scales to time scales is actually not that far back. If I go to 0.3, a redshift of 0.3 and about the same temperature, I've already reached the Bullitt cluster, which remember was about a gigaparsec away. So that's a long distance. But it's not a large time in terms of the history of the universe measured in redshift. So there's many other important epochs. Let me just mention a couple of these. So firstly, if we go to a redshift of roughly 20, or a temperature of 5 milliEV, this is roughly where we think reionization occurred. So recall, if we work in the other direction, we think initially we had ionized protons and electrons, which at recombination combined to form atomic hydrogen. And then later on in the universe, we think various sources of radiation reionize that. So that again, most of what we have is protons and electrons separated. So this is really an active area of investigation because you can probe this with 21 centimeter cosmology, and probably many of you have heard about this. Then there's sort of a gap up to recombination at a redshift about 1100 or 0.3 eV. And you may have heard of this terminology, but this gap here is sometimes referred to as the Dark Ages. Of course, we've had several of these as a species, but this is one in terms of cosmology, because there was not a lot happening essentially here. We essentially just had neutral hydrogen, and it was not until this later time here when stars, et cetera, started to form and the universe started to become a more interesting place. Nonetheless, because this is a reasonably clean environment, because not a lot's going on, you can actually sometimes probe very interesting properties of dark matter. If dark matter was, for example, injecting some energy during these epochs, it can actually have measurable impacts, for example, on the CMB. So it's an interesting era for probing dark matter, but not a ton was going on here. Then if we go back a little bit further, I think I'll give up on outer space. If we go to a redshift of roughly 3400, when the CMB temperature was about 0.8 eV, we hit the very important epoch of matter radiation equality. A lot of things changed in how the universe evolved at this point. And then if we go slightly further back, or quite a bit further back, to a redshift of 2 by 10 to the 10, when the temperature was 5 MeV. This is roughly when we think Big Bang nuclear synthesis had to begin. So So recall, I mean, maybe this has already been covered in these lectures or will be later on, but Big Bang nucleosynthesis is how we think that a lot of the light elements formed out of the primordial plasma. And we can come up with very detailed predictions for how much hydrogen, helium there should be, for example, and also some of the heavier nuclei. And they're in generally very good agreement with our observations, which I think is one of the real successes of early universe cosmology. So as a general rule, we would say we have a reasonably direct measurement that BBN actually occurred because our predictions so accurately match what we see. And because of this, we think that we roughly understand what was happening in the universe up to 5 MeV because of this. So then what about above 5 MeV? Well, this is where we have no idea, truthfully. We have many thoughts about what could be happening here. Of course, you know, the standard picture is something like the Big Bang occurred, then there was inflation, there was reheating, potentially you reheated to very high temperatures, there was various epochs like an electroweak phase transition. But this is all speculative. Truthfully, the really only direct evidence we have is that the universe existed up to a temperature of about 5 MeV, and maybe it just popped into existence right at that temperature. I mean, this would be very unsatisfying, but as far as the evidence tells us, that seems plausible. Please.
So just a technical question. So when you're expressing temperatures in MeV, I suppose this is with the units where Boltzmann constant is 1, right? I'm just trying to understand the...
Yes, yeah, exactly. Yeah. No, so for example, keeping track of this, you can convert this to 2.7 EV, for example, right? Which is the modern temperature, the present temperature of the CMB.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. Good question. Thank you. Please.
What is the unit
for bullet cluster? For 0.3, and it's the same temperature effectively. The redshift is 0.3. Essentially, I mean, you're starting to get cosmological, you know, spectral lines are shifting by some measurable amount. But in terms of how far a redshift we're going, it's not that, doesn't seem like it's that far along. Although, I mean, it's interesting to keep in mind that that's a gigaparsec. So in addition to just setting the scale for, I mean, what's happening in the universe, probably many of you have seen bits of this before, when we come to later describe specific dark matter models, it'll be useful to understand where they're changing something that's going on here with respect to some of these epochs. So I find it useful to mention this. But of course, when we're talking about the CMB, what we're looking at in particular is the light that was emitted here. So this is the CMB, and I want to very quickly tell you how the CMB gives us two pieces of evidence that strongly tell us that something like dark matter had to exist, and also it had to be in existence at the time the CMB was emitted. In fact, we have indirect evidence that dark matter existed at much, much higher redshifts, but let me not go into that unless there's questions. So let me tell you roughly how the CMB implies that dark matter exists. The first one, and this is somewhat indirect in the sense that from what we see in the CMB, it is completely inconsistent with baryons giving rise to the large-scale structure we see in the universe around us. The reason for this is that the temperature anisotropies we see in the CMB, so the delta T over the average temperature in the CMB, we know are set by overdensities in the baryons. So these are coming from, if I have some overdensity in the baryons, which is usually defined as this delta. And we can observe, I mean, when we see the CMB map, there's foregrounds we have to exclude. There's the fact that the sun has a peculiar velocity with respect to the Hubble flow. We subtract that off. But once we've done that, we see this pristine map of these fluctuations that surely you've all seen at some point. And they're roughly at the size of 10 to the minus 5, okay? So let's combine this with another fact from cosmology that I won't derive here, which says that in the matter dominated era, these overdensities grow linearly with the scale factor. So that means if we, at the CMB era, if we measure them to be about the size of 10 to the minus 5, that means that these structures now would be, commonly for now, we put a superscript or a subscript 0, they would be 10 to the minus 5 times 1100, which is about 10 to the minus 2. And the key thing here is this is much less than 1. Whereas everywhere we look around us, we see significant overdensities, much, much larger than 1. I mean, everybody in this room is a specific example of that. But we see that in the form of galaxies, etc. And it seems that if all we had was baryons, there just isn't enough time between recombination and now for nonlinear structures to have formed. Now, of course, this is a very rough argument. I'm saying like the average size of these fluctuations is 10 to the minus 5. There's a distribution of these. And maybe some of the ones that are larger fluctuations away from this mean value could have collapsed in time. But if you go through a detailed analysis, there is absolutely no way that baryons alone could have been giving us the seeds of structure that make that are consistent with the large-scale universe that we see around us. So this is telling us that something else had to be present to seed those overdensities at the time of the CMB epoch, and it had to have overdensities that were larger than 10 to the minus 5. So this is what the dark matter is going to be. It's going to be these overdensities, and we'll see another impact of those in a moment in the second piece of evidence for the CMB. But the other thing that this tells us immediately is that although it was very, I'll come to you in 1 second, although it was very hard to exclude this originally, it's now essentially impossible that whatever this dark matter is, it could be made up of essentially like these rogue planets or these very dim stars that people talked about. And it was very hard to understand why they would have the properties that we saw dark matter does, but to explicitly exclude that seems difficult. But given that those objects are formed from baryons and that the baryons themselves just could not form the structure we have in the universe around us, this is what excludes essentially those sorts of possibilities as being dark matter. And recall this happened reasonably late in the history of science. It was only in the mid-90s that we really got detailed measurements of what we see in the CMB. Please.
Which part of the argument takes into account the fact that you're only accounting for baryons here?
Good. So the part of this is that the temperature fluctuations in the CMB are determined by the inhomogeneities in the baryonic matter, and these are measured from what we see in the CMB to be of the order of 10 to the minus 5. I mean, exactly how that line of logic works through, like why the temperatures are exactly sourced by this, is a bit more than I'm going through here, but that is roughly true in what we see in the CMB, and they're just much too small to have grown into something that would give us the nonlinear universe that we see around us.
Why, if we include dark matter, presumably we'd still get the overdensity in the matter sector, which is of the order of 10 to the minus 5, which would still grow at the same rate.
Unless, I mean, for example, this is just if we're letting this thing grow on its own. Imagine that the dark matter is seeding overdensities that the baryons can fall into. And that is exactly what we think happens, is that the dark matter seeds overdensities that the baryons fall into, and then they can form nonlinear structures faster because their growth is being influenced by the dark matter. This is if we only had the baryons on their own, they would evolve in this way. But when you have the presence of the dark matter overdensities, that will enhance the growth of the baryonic ones, because they'll often fall into, I mean, intuitively, they'll fall into
the dark matter overdensities be of the same order originally.
I mean, in the CMB, we don't directly measure the dark matter overdensities, and we know that they have to have been larger in order to source the... Yeah, no, good question. Yeah.
So, don't dark matter perturbations go at the same rate as the scale factor? Like?
They do, and what we're inferring from this is they had to be larger at the epoch of CMB. But we don't directly measure them because they're not what's sourcing the temperature and isotropies. Good question. So again, I mean, this is, I think as the questions are teasing out, I'm not really doing justice to all of the physics here. I just want to give you some intuitive picture about why there is evidence, this first piece of evidence in the CMB combined with large-scale structure, that something beyond baryons had to be seeding things. Please.
I mean, the proof in the CMB due to dark matter is comparable to the predictions of inflation. I know these two stories are different completely. But are they comparable with each other?
So in terms of the primordial density fluctuation you get from dark matter, you can make that, I believe that they are consistent with what we expect in terms of structure formation. I mean, I can't remember the exact argument, but we think that the initial density fluctuations were like of order 10 to the minus 4. I mean, someone may be able to correct me on that. But then the reality is that in the radiation epoch, they don't grow very much. We think they only grow logarithmically, or we know that they should only grow logarithmically. And then they have very rapid growth from beyond this 3400 period when they start growing linearly. But they can be large enough that easily you can start forming nonlinear structures, even at redshifts of order 10 or earlier, for example. So some things are starting to collapse. But again, to go through a detailed analysis of this, it's going to be more than this. You need to think about the full distribution of these overdensities, which we usually model as Gaussian, for example, and keep track that it's the largest values of those are the ones that collapse. So there's a lot more that can be said about this. I'm not sure if it will be covered in the cosmology lectures, but it's usually covered in some cosmology textbook or course on this. Good, so let me turn to the second piece of evidence, which will involve me doing another desperate attempt at drawing a well-known plot. And so this is the CMB power spectrum. So let me attempt to draw this. Please bear with me. It's So what I'm showing you on the y-axis here is what is the power spectrum of the CMB, which, if you remember, or for those of you who haven't seen it before, is roughly a measure of what is the variance in the temperature of the sky at a given spatial scale. So it's a measure of what is the size of the fluctuations in the system at that scale. So certain spatial scale have larger fluctuations than others. And what I'm putting on the x-axis is that spatial scale. So I'll put it in degree, just to maybe make it a bit more intuitive. But of course, you would have seen this plot before, measured in the multipole L. And just for reference, the angular scale is roughly 180 degrees divided by the multipole. So there's a mapping between these. So I'll just go for it, and we'll see what happens here. OK, it looks something like that. That is definitely higher than, anyway, on we go. So this is a scale of about 1 degree, and the third peak, I think, is a scale of about 0.2. And there's an enormous amount of physics that you can pull out of this, but let me just put that aside for the moment and try and pull one piece of physics out and ask, why are we roughly seeing these peaks in this distribution here? And to think about this, we can draw on the fact that we needed to have these larger overdensities in dark matter than we had in the baryons. And so a very, very rough picture of this, of why the peaks, is that you can imagine that there are clusters, some overdensity of dark matter. And I should have mentioned this earlier on, especially in response to the questions, one second. The reason why dark matter baryons don't start clustering until recombination is because as they try and do this, the radiation pressure forces them apart because they're ionized protons and electrons. Any attempt to really form structure gravitationally is repelled. But you can imagine if you had some component that didn't interact with radiation, it could have been forming structures this entire time, which is exactly sort of what we expect dark matter to be doing. Please, there was a question.
Why is the axis that way, like 1 before 0.2?
Because this is commonly, I mean, I could plot it however I wanted, that's fair. It's just commonly when you see this, it's plotted from smaller to larger multipole. It's often when you see the CMB power spectrum from low to high, and because there's an inverse relationship between angular and multipole, just to sort of map up to what you conventionally see when you plot the CMB scale, I've chosen to plot it this way. You can plot it the other way you want it as well, but also there's a lot of structure that's going on down here, so depending on how you plot it, it could be all compressed in the small part of your axis. Yeah.
Okay.
To give you some sense, again, like what's happening here is on the larger spatial scales, and this is going down to much smaller and smaller spatial scales. So it's only with more recent technologies that we've been able to probe this high part of the, because you need very, very good resolution maps in order to pull that information out, for example. So there's sort of also some historical progress here. So coming back to why we're seeing the peaks, so we imagine that there's some potential well that's being sourced by dark matter. And we have some baryon that, thanks to gravity, wants to fall into this. But as I just told you, there's something that's stopping it from just collapsing in, and that is that radiation is pushing it back out. And what happens often in physics when you have two competing forces, the system begins to oscillate, for example. And so what we're exactly seeing in these power spectrum is essentially the scale of these oscillations. I mean, there's so much more going on here. This is almost an embarrassing oversimplification, but I think it's roughly one way you can think about this. And so, for example, the spatial scale is associated with the compression aspect of this oscillation. They're going to be the first peak here and the third. And then the rarefaction, or the outgoing one, is like the middle one here. And so what you can get from this, though, is you can see if I added more and more dark matter, I'm going to increase the compression aspect of this peak. And so this is very qualitative, but by adding more dark matter or by changing the amount of dark matter, I will change the ratio of these different peaks here, you can imagine. So dm changes the peak.
So it was, that was the second peak.
Unbelievable, yeah. Rare effaction. Firstly, I'm not even sure that's how you spell it. And secondly, that's how I've attempted to write it. So good. I think it's how you spell it. But anyway, the rest of it, yeah, that's fair enough. So if you combine this, I won't attempt to draw this, but probably many of you have seen maps of the CMB power spectrum. And you've also seen, on top of some theoretical prediction, there are these obscenely precise measurements. And so from this, you can begin to imagine that if I change the amount of dark matter, I'm going to change this in a way that I'm very sensitive to with the CMB. And indeed, this is exactly correct. And this is where we get this number that the omega CDM over omega M equals 0.84. I mean, as I said, there are other ways of measuring this, but this is really the most precise. And it tells you that we have the majority of the matter in the universe in this dark matter. So hopefully this gives you some intuition for this, but I think to really understand it, you have to work through the detailed cosmological calculations to know where this is coming out. And ultimately, this is where we get this really precise number that is always quoted. It's not from the Bullock cluster, it's not from rotation curves, it's from the CMB. Please.
Does this oscillation produce, distance stability? Does this oscillation produce particles, kind of radiation or
it's literally the what I'm keeping track of is the oscillations of the baryons themselves, right? Because the oscillations of the baryons are where there's regions where there's higher numbers of baryons. Hope I'm not getting this the wrong way around. I'll have a system that's a slightly higher temperature. So that's going to impact the CMB power spectrum.
There's no relation to the misalignment mechanism.
I will talk about the misalignment mechanism later on, but for example, in terms of our history of the universe, the dark matter had to already be completely set by this time. So misalignment will be happening much, much, much earlier in the history. And so this is why it's useful to have this map in mind, because normally where we think misalignment occurred is in the ... region, for example. But yeah, fair question. So this was very brief. A very brief accounting of, what is the most compelling evidence we have for dark matter in some sense. Maybe less visceral than the rotation curves of the Bullock cluster, but the most precise. So with that, I was going to leave this and move on to the argument that dark matter could be a particle. But before I do so, please, if there's any more questions about this, ask them now or find me later. Good. Okay. So just to recap, what we have at this stage is that we have evidence that there's an enormous amount of additional matter, and step by step, we've ruled out various possibilities. For instance, you might have thought that it was gas. This is what people first did, but we didn't see that in any of the observations. You might have thought that it was some modification to gravity, but instances like the Bullock cluster, or also the CMB, in truth, make it extremely hard to understand how modified gravity could be consistent with what we're seeing here. Also, you could imagine that maybe it's something like some additional baryonic matter, like brown dwarfs or planets. But again, the fact that it had to be completely in place by recombination says that whatever these objects are, we do not think they're made of the other baryons we see around us. And we don't expect planets to form in the ... region, for example. This doesn't rule out every possible baryonic source. For example, I mean, it could have been that there were black holes seeded at very, very early times. And this is something hopefully I'll mention later on. So that is still a possibility, but they cannot be black holes formed from stars, because we know stars only form late in the universe, at least from this way of measuring the history. And the fact that this additional matter component had to be set at the time of the CMB is inconsistent with that. Please.
Yeah, one more question to the CMB argument you have. It says that dark matter changes the peak. How model dependent is this? Do you know what I mean? How much do you rely on dark matter already being in place for that argument?
I think in detail, what you require is dark matter to have formed enough of a potential well at that stage. Now, you can make this quantitative, like how much of a potential well did you need to have, and when exactly did dark matter have to start behaving cold? Now, this you can go through quite a quantitative argument here. In fact, in terms of keeping track of it, there's a relationship between the sizes of the dark matter over densities and what actually collapses into different structures in the universe. Certain over densities collapse to form massive halos, like we see like the galaxy clusters we talked about, or others form the very smallest. And so actually it turns out the smallest objects we see, we think had to have already been starting to form already having to start forming structures from a temperature of a keV. So not quite as high as this. But you can ask, how early did it have to be set? We think dark matter had to be in place and behaving roughly cold. If it was too warm, you would change this picture slightly as well, from about a keV. The quantitative aspect of this argument, I'm happy to talk about offline, but it's a bit involved, so I won't do this here. So we do know more than I'm presenting here in many, many ways. Very good question. Good, so what I want to turn to now, as I said, I mean, the hypothesis that this leaves is that maybe dark matter could be a particle. So what I want to focus on next is the particle landscape. And in particular, I'll look at three windows. I mean, the broad picture I want to answer here is, if we take seriously the possibility that dark matter is a particle, I want to ask questions like, what could it possibly be, and what do we know for certain that particle cannot be, for instance? But we'll find there's still a lot that's allowed. And in particular, I'll look at three different windows, which I'll dub what I would call the classics. Then I'll look at heavy dark matter, and then I'll look at ultralight or wave-like dark matter. And just to say some more words, I mean, historically it took a while for people to start thinking about the idea that dark matter could be a new particle. This is not where people started. But just to say some words about why this isn't maybe completely ridiculous, I mean, in the particle physics community, we have no trouble generating new particles that could exist in the universe. And not only that, I think in many of the ways that we end up trying to solve some of the deepest questions we have, like the hierarchy problem or the strong CP problem, we end up predicting that there's some new state there. So it's not at all unreasonable that we would think that there are more particles beyond those we know of in the Standard Model. Additionally, from the sort of the bottom-up perspective, the description of the universe as made up of particles at a fundamental level is an incredibly successful one. For all the baryonic matter, we know that that is the truth. So the idea that maybe this additional matter component is also made up of a particle, I think, is a very reasonable one to put forward. Although I agree that maybe when you first look at this, you might have thought of modified gravity or gas. This doesn't seem to be consistent with the data. So let me... So also just to quickly mention, I mean, some of the things we remember from this morning is that we know from the Bullet cluster, dark matter can't be strongly self-interacting, or at least so strongly that you'd muck up what you see in the Bullet cluster. Or also, the fact that we see dark matter is roughly in these spherical halos around galaxies tell us that it cannot be considerably dissipative. But for all of these statements, and this is the game of dark matter model building, you can also usually take some fraction of dark matter to have all the properties that you know that most of it can't, just to see what goes on. So what I really want to answer is, if this particle is a, if this dark matter is a particle, what are its fundamental properties? And then the first thing to think about here is, well, what are the fundamental properties of a particle? And so the correct way of answering this is to go to the PDG and to see what is stated for various particles. And the first thing that's usually stated there is the spin of the particle, but I'll say some words about the spin of dark matter, but largely I'll leave that aside. And then the next thing that is usually stated here is, what is the mass? And this feels like a really fundamental aspect of a particle, is that it has some mass associated with it. So a question I would love to know the answer to is, what is the mass of dark matter? So just to orient ourselves, I just want to spend a few minutes talking about the masses of particles in the Standard Model. Although I know Brian has already covered this, I just want to use this to set the scale. So what am I going to put here? Okay, so let me start out at an MeV, roughly here. There's a very famous particle, that's the electron, one of my favorites. Then as we go up to a GeV, of course we have the proton. I mean, it's not a fundamental particle, but it plays a considerable role in the universe. And then as we go to a TeV, well, we don't have anything quite up here, but at roughly this here, we have the top quark, which is the heaviest particle in the Standard Model, at roughly 173. GeV. And so in the Standard Model, at least as it's conventionally written, the lightest state is the electron. But of course, I believe in Brian's lecture this morning, you talked about other states we know about that seem to have even lighter masses, although they're not predicted in the Standard Model. And those are the neutrinos, which have a mass of at least 0.5 EV, at least one of them does. So can anyone tell me why the neutrinos are so much lighter than all the other states? If so, I would like to write a paper with you. I think that that's very much an open question, right? And I think more generally, although there are many orders of magnitude here, there are also many open questions that are going on, not just with the neutrinos.
Well, I think the phenomenological answer to your question would be because they don't decay to lighter particles.
But that, I mean, That doesn't explain why they're essentially six orders of magnitude lighter than the electron, right? Which is almost the distance of the electron up to the top quark, right? So I think that the fact that there's this double hierarchy, and not only that, the fact that all three of them seem to be around here, or at least one of them I think can still be consistent with massless, is shocking, I think. And there's many problems we have in the standard model in terms of explaining this. Nonetheless, let's just leave that aside and move on to an even more profound order of magnitude issue, which is the range over which dark matter can have mass. So what I'm going to show you now is that we roughly think that the mass of dark matter could exist over 87 orders of magnitude. Okay. Very good, but not infinite. Yeah. I'll put this here. So at the very lightest end, I'll mention this. There's the sort of fuzzy dark matter limit, which is heavily debated. And people say it's somewhere between 10 to the minus 22 and 10 to the minus 19 EV. Okay, that's that. Let's put the standard model roughly somewhere in here at about a GeV. We have the proton. And so what do we have here? We have 30 orders of magnitude. And then how high could the mass of dark matter be? Well, as I'll review for you today, we think it can be up to roughly a solar mass, although maybe it could be a couple of orders of magnitude lighter than this. So you could go all the way up to a solar mass here. And so this is another 57 orders of magnitude. So you can view this two ways. On the one way, this is concerning. On the other side, it also represents some very interesting possibilities, because dark matter at this mass is going to behave very differently to dark matter at the other mass, and we're going to need very different techniques to search for it. And so I'll come to that. Sorry, one question. There's a question back there.
That solar mass would be for a particle
primordial
black holes?
You're touching on, no, it's related. For primordial black holes, we know they have to be even lighter, actually. I'll say some words about 10 to the minus 7 solar masses or lighter. But what exactly you mean by a particle up here, I'll have to describe that for you today. So it's a very good question. I'll come back to that. Please.
Yeah, I was actually going to ask a very similar question. So I was just going to ask, if you had like a particle this massive, wouldn't it just like be a black hole? Because you'd have a, unless the particle is actually bigger than its Schwarzschild radius.
Yeah. So what you're saying is exactly correct, and we'll have to come to that later on. But we can have, I mean, dark matter could be a composite object, right? I'll review this. I'm heavier than the Planck scale, which is roughly where that transition occurs. So things can exist at that scale, and maybe these things are dark matter. I'm not particularly luminous, so I'm not saying that I'm dark matter, but at least something of that variety could do it. Please.
Yeah, I heard the argument before once or twice that the Junius, for example, could not be dark matter.
We'll cover this, exactly. No. Well, there's the famous bound explaining why neutrinos can't. So let me ask you, answer your question, but I think preempting is many of the things I'll talk about.
Okay.
So it's exactly right. I already told you it's not something in the standard model, but what neutrinos seem like a very good candidate. So I will have to come back to you later on and explain why that is. And we do know for certain it's not neutrinos, but a priori it's not so clear. And actually for quite a long time, people thought about that. So excellent questions. I don't mean to be dismissive. I just don't want to spoil my entire lecture at the end. So let me now give you my favorite unit conversion this is just remarkable. So let me share you this. So here I've got EV and here I've got solar masses. So how do you convert between the two of them? Okay. The following is an extremely accurate conversion. I mean, again, you can do all these things in Mathematica, but that's not the fun. So it's the solar mass can be written as the Planck mass cubed divided by the proton mass squared, okay? So if we put this together, remember the Planck mass is 10 to the 19 GeV roughly, cubed, and the proton mass is about 1 GeV squared. What we get is 19 times 3 or 10 to the 57 GeV for this conversion here. So I think I actually got this from one of Cliff's lecture notes, that this following factoid I'm about to tell you is that I think this is a very natural way of describing the mass of the sun. And the reason for this is that the sun is made of hydrogen mostly, right? And the most of the mass of hydrogen is about 1 GeV. So this tells you that the sun is about 10 to the 57 particles, which tells you more than how many kilograms it is, I would argue. But the other thing that is remarkable about that is that there is physics in this this relationship here. And I think, at least naively, it is counterintuitive. You would think the sun is made of protons, So if I make the proton heavier, why would the sun get lighter? Okay, but this is nonetheless what this conversion factor is stating for you. And I would be delighted to talk about this with any of you, but I don't want to spoil the fun. So let me just leave this as an exercise. So you can actually derive where this is coming from, roughly. It's not just completely out of the blue, which I find remarkable. There is physics as to why making the proton heavier would make the sun lighter. So in order to do this, you can apply the Virial theorem, which we talked about, to the sun, so that you really can treat this as a gas of particles. And the question you might want to ask, well, the question you should ask, is what is the number of particles in the sun? Just imagine that it's all made up of hydrogen, which has the mass of proton. Number of particles. And because they're all protons, once you know the number of particles in the sun, you also know the mass of the sun. What is the number of particles when, for this system, the gas pressure, which you know is from the ideal gas law, is equal to the radiation pressure, which recall scales as T to the fourth. It's like the Stefan-Boltzmann law. So why is this an interesting point to calculate? Well, it's not exactly correct, but we roughly expect that once stars are radiation dominated, they become very unstable. Small oscillations in their radius can have an enormous impact on their temperature, and they generally tend not to be very stable objects and can disintegrate. So you would think that this would roughly be an upper limit or some stability limit on these sorts of objects. But this is just going to give you a one-sided bound, but nonetheless, you can figure out what it is, and you'll find it's very close to this here. And as you do that calculation, you already understand why the proton mass appears on the denominator there. And if you want to see that we can bound this from the other side, read this beautiful paper by Carr and Rees from 1979. So this is one of my favorite calculations in physics. I think it's very spectacular. So let me just leave that as an exercise. But I'd be very happy to talk about this with anyone tomorrow or later on, but I just want to give you a chance to have a think about it. Good. So that's the landscape that I want to cover now. And as has already been alluded to in some of the questions, there are very interesting, you know, benchmarks that we're going to come across, like where does the neutrino mass fall in this? You know, why couldn't that be dark matter? At what point have I transitioned from particles to composite objects? These are all interesting points we'll have to hit. But let me start out just by keeping track of what are the basic factors we know about dark matter locally. And the reason for this is ultimately whatever this substance is, we want to detect it. And so it's very useful to think of, I mean, this dark matter is everywhere. How much of it is there near us on the Earth so we can keep track of whether we might be able to make an easy measurement with some sort of terrestrial experiment? So let me just run through some basic properties of this. And it also gives me a chance to draw another spiral galaxy. So what I want to do, keep track of here essentially is some of the dark matter properties that we covered in the first lecture, but just so that we can turn them into this particle language here. So let's do the basics of the Milky Way. If we look at the baryons, we know that the radius of this system here, as I told you, is about for the Andromeda, it's about 25 kiloparsecs. For the Milky Way, it's roughly 30 kiloparsecs. And where do we live? This is the sun. We live a distance of about 8 kiloparsecs. So sort of in the middle, and I believe we live in one of the spiral arms, although they're not enormous overdensities. But as was discussed this morning, this object exists in some massive cloud of what we think are particles, which is dark matter. So perfectly to scale. There's my spiral galaxy, which has a size of about a radius of about 30 kiloparsecs, and we think that the dark matter halo has a radius of roughly 200 kiloparsecs. But as was very well observed in one of the questions this morning, the exact boundary of this is very only roughly defined, but it is about an order of magnitude larger than what we see baryonic matter over. I mean, similarly, the exact boundary of this thing is not super well defined. It's just dropping off. So one other point I also mentioned earlier on is that the Milky Way doesn't just exist in isolation. There's all sorts of spiral galaxies around this. like the large and the small Magellanic clouds, and also all of the dwarf galaxies. And these are very interesting because these property objects are actually some of the ones that we have give us the best measurement of the global potential of the Milky Way, because they're so far away. And for example, actually the best measurements of the mass of the Milky Way come from following the orbits of some of these systems that are very large radii that, we know are orbiting around our own system. Please.
One question that I've always had. If galaxies can be regarded as like light on a plane, more or less, why do halos are always like spheres?
Ah, so, I mean, this is related to something that was discussed earlier on, that baryons are dissipative. So because they can lose energy, they can start to, collapse under gravity. But they can't completely collapse to a point because that's inconsistent with conservation of angular momentum. So they end up collapsing to a rotating disk, is what you see. But for dark matter, the fact that it never seems to collapse, it stays like this puffy ball around, tells us that whatever dark matter is, it's not considerably dissipative. So you could have, I think as I was mentioning earlier on, a subfraction of dark matter could have been dissipative and played a fatal role in the history of the dinosaurs. But the basic picture is the dominant contribution of dark matter could not do that. That's a very good question. This is what we think is going on. And again, the claim is that the majority of what this is, this isn't my hot gas this time, this is the dark matter. And there's just this gas in some senses of particles that are flying all over the place with a mass varying from 10 to the minus 21 to a solar mass. Okay, so let's pull some of our other basic properties from this morning. So as I said, the dark matter here we think is, it doesn't have any coherent motion like in a disk, it's just some gas of particles flying around. But we can still determine at the location of the Earth roughly what is the average speed of the particles in this gas, because that's going to be dictated by the virial theorem again. So locally, dm is a gas, and it has a velocity dispersion, sort of the range over which the velocities vary, of the enclosed mass over r. And so if you put this in, this is roughly 232 kilometers a second. But if we're observing this gas, something that is important to keep in mind is that we're not just at rest in this halo, we're moving around the center of the galaxy. Okay, I mean, we're also moving around the sun, but I told you earlier on that that was about 30 kilometers a second. In principle, sometimes you need to keep track of it, but we'll find that the speed of the sun around the center of the Milky Way is an even faster speed.
So what is this dispersion relation?
This is the average range over the width of the distribution of the velocities of dark matter at roughly a point at about 8 kiloparsecs away. Now, it's not, they don't have a bulk motion, so they're not moving in a circle, so I can't use, for example, like the centripetal acceleration, but the average range of the speeds will still obey the virial theorem, and so it will be of order this size here. Please.
Why do you assume dark matter gas is virialized?
This is, so, the system, if, again, it goes back to like when, under what assumptions does the virial theorem hold, right? And the shocking thing is that it holds under very general assumptions. Like, if this system is essentially not evolving enormously over time, then we can then the virial theorem will hold. Like this derivative of the average derivative, the average of the derivative of the moment of inertia tensor vanishes. So under those conditions, this holds. And it seems very reasonable for a halo that formed, we think, many billions of years ago. And there has been important steps in the evolution of the Milky Way, but not so dramatic that I would think that it's not satisfying the virial theorem. Now, is this a question that people argue about a lot? Is the dark matter actually, you know, fully in equilibrium? Can I describe it as like having some temperature and things like that? People, this is often a simplifying assumption people make, but now as we've, especially from Gaia, which some of you might have heard about, we've learned that there's been recent dramatic events in the history of the Milky Way that shows that locally, actually, dark matter is probably not in equilibrium. It hasn't had enough time to equilibrate yet. But these are reasonable assumptions, but being in equilibrium is a much stronger assumption than the virial theorem holding, is what I would say. But it's a very interesting question. Yeah. Good, but yeah, so while the gas won't have a bulk motion, we do, and we're trying to observe this dark matter, and the velocity of the Earth, which you can determine from, this is essentially what we spent all of our time in rotation curves discussing, you can work out is also about 200 kilometers a second, shock horror, because it's dictated by the exact same factors here. And if I can convert 200 kilometers a second to a speed in natural units, it's about 10 to the minus 3 here. In fact, both of these values, if I can convert them to natural units, are very small. So locally, even once we account for our bulk motion, dark matter will be moving non-relativistically. And it's quite nice that we know this, I mean, just from the virial theorem. It's completely independent of how massive dark matter is. And just to say, that might be somewhat counterintuitive, but if dark matter was moving much faster, it would be pushed out to larger radii, or eventually it would exceed the escape velocity of the Milky Way and would fly away. So at late times, we wouldn't expect it to be near where we are locally. Good, so there's one other. So this is telling us that locally, we're moving at some speed of about 200 kilometers a second through a gas that has a dispersion of about 200 kilometers a second. These are going to be useful numbers to pull up in a moment. But the other question you can have is, well, how much dark matter is there locally? If we want to make a detection, I mean, how many particles do we have around to play with? I wish we knew this. We don't. Instead, what I can tell you is how much dark matter mass is there. And the reason, of course, that I can say something about this is because it's that mass that has a gravitational impact on the stars around us. And so by measuring those precisely, we can make some inference about how much dark matter mass there is locally. And what we know is that there's roughly a proton mass worth, or more accurately, 0.4 GeV per centimeter cubed of dark matter. So people will quote this as being local. And by local, you might hope that this means like within the room or something like that, because that's the scale hinted at with units like centimeters. But actually, where we measure the local dark matter density on the smallest scale is on the order of hundreds of parsecs. And often it's on larger scales than this. So you could wonder, well, maybe we got unlucky and dark matter has some enormous inhomogeneities. If that was the case, maybe there's no dark matter locally. Dear God, I hope that's not the case, but we can't be certain at this stage. Really, all that we can measure directly is over much larger distances. And the reason for this is that this is not a big number. I mean, there's far more than one proton per centimeter cubed in the sun and on the Earth. So this only starts to have a large gravitational impact as we go to larger and larger volumes. So just to give you some reference for this, at least I find this a helpful number to keep in mind, just compute what is the total dark matter density, or the total dark matter, so the mass of dark matter, say in solar masses. You can now convert between GeV and solar masses as you please, in the solar system, for example. So obviously, the gravitational force in the solar system in the baryonic sector is dominated by the sun. It's interesting to compare how much dark matter could be playing a role over that scale here. Good, so these are just the basic properties, like how fast we're moving through this wind, what is the dispersion of that wind, and how many particles are there, that I now want to draw on to figure out what are some basic properties of what this dark matter might be doing locally.
We have good reasons to believe that, for example, on the solar scale level, because we can explain everything perfectly by GR and Newtonian gravity, so we shouldn't see any effects of dark matter on very large scales. So probably we can translate this into lower mass, the distance density, or some screening mechanism, right? So
I think I'm missing some part. I mean, on the larger scales, we definitely see evidence for dark matter. So what do you mean by large in this context?
No. I mean solar systems.
Yeah.
So on that scale, if there is another gravitating force, it will mess things up.
Yes. Well, it will be observable. Yeah.
I mean, it should be observable, but we can't explain it perfectly.
Yeah.
By GR. So basically, my question relates to this density that you just.
I think I'm very happy to talk about this later or tomorrow, but I think the answer to your question is given by this exercise. And if you compute how much dark matter this corresponds to within the solar system and compare that to the sun, you will see that it's going to be quite hard to say anything on solar system scales. Does that possibly make sense? So maybe just compute this number, compare it to the sun, and then think, how would you actually detect this? However, as much as you're going to find that it's challenging, there is actually an experimental proposal to send satellites out to the edge of the solar system and measure the dark matter density very locally, which would at least remove this nightmare scenario that there's none here. But it's actually quite a futuristic measurement because it's an extremely hard thing to do. But I'm sort of giving away the answer here. Please work that out. I think it's a useful number to keep in mind. So next I want to put some of these numbers together just so we can get a rough intuition for if we ever had some instrument that could detect dark matter, and we do, what might actually be going through it, for example. Okay, so I mean, this is of course what we can see, but what we actually want to know is how many dark matter particles are around, for example. And so from rho chi, we can determine how many particles there are just by dividing by the mass. Okay, we don't know what that is, but we can still do this. And so the number of particles is going to be 0.4 for a dark matter particle of 1 GeV. And then as we go much heavier, there'll be far fewer particles, and much lighter, there'll be far more particles. Okay. The next question you can ask is, if I put some, if I'm just standing here, what is the wind of dark matter that is passing through me based on this? Or what is the flux of dark matter? And for this, I just need to multiply the number density times the speed that it's moving through me. But I already told you I roughly know what speed it's moving through me. It's at roughly 10 to the minus 3 in natural units. Good. Or if I keep this in non-natural units, it's around 200 kilometers a second. And so if I did the conversion correctly, this will be 'And this will have units of flux, so the number of particles per size of the area they're passing through, here centimeter squared, and how long I wait, so units of second here. So based on this, please go ahead. Yeah. Oh,
thank you. And these particles are running this huge radius. Are they in thermal equilibrium? Is there a collisionless?
We don't think so. As I was mentioning, actually what we think happened was, I can't remember exactly, but a few giga years ago, we think that the Milky Way had a collision with another very massive galaxy. And so what is happening is that there'll be all sorts of violent oscillations going on as the system then comes down to at rest. We don't think that process is finished. And so in that sense that we believe, but this is only very recently, I believe this has come from the Gaia satellite. I mean, there are papers with the title of something like dark matter in disequilibria or something like that in the last few years. But so this is a very recent picture we have. How close it is to equilibrium, I've read the abstract of those papers. I haven't read them in detail. I point you to them. Yeah. Good.
So, what is this flux?
This flux is how many, and it's meant to be multiplied by V, how many dark matter particles, if I have like a centimeter squared, I guess that's how big that is, how many dark matter particles are flying through that in 1 second? And it's this number for a particle mass of 1 GeV, okay? So then just to get some feeling for this, if I take it to be literally 1 GeV, how many particles would I get if I mean, let's just get a feeling for how big a detector could we build. Current funding says that it's not going to be much larger than 1 meter squared. And then human lifetime suggests that we don't want to wait that long, so let's say about 1 year. So we can put all of these numbers together, use that a year is pi times 10 to the 7. But let me just tell you that this is 3 by 10 to the 18 particles that you would get through your instrument in 1 year. So if they have some reasonable cross-section with the material you've made, maybe you can hope to see something. But something else hopefully you can get an impression from this is that this is going to get harder if I make the mass heavier and heavier. So for example, if I take the dark matter to be a mass of about the Planck mass, which was 10 to the 19 GeV, then the number of particles I get in 1 year is 0.33, or about a third. So this one, well, you really better catch that particle when it comes through, because you're going to have to wait a long time otherwise. And this is just a very general thing that what's called direct detection, where we look for something in an instrument at the Earth, gets harder and harder as the dark matter mass goes up. Harder. And you can imagine it's going to be exceptionally hard if dark matter is right at the upper end here. So maybe again, I mean, these are very simple things, but I just find it useful to keep some of these basic numbers in my mind. If you waited again 1 year, which we're kind of stuck with, if you took the area to be the entire solar system cross-section area, what mass could you go up to? Do you again get the n chi equal 1? So you're going to a much larger area here, so you can go to a much larger mass. Can you make it all the way to the solar mass or not? Can you cover those 57 orders of magnitude, is the question there. So that's the big picture here. These are some useful numbers that are worth keeping in mind as we start moving through this particle landscape. And what I want to turn to next is, so we could go anywhere. As I said, the goal is, I'll start in what I call the classic window, which is where dark matter has a mass comparable to what you've been talking about in the standard model, so around this proton mass range. And then I'll turn to the possibility that dark matter could be much heavier, so move to the right, and end with the possibility that dark matter could be much lighter, and this will likely have to be tomorrow. But are there any, can I get this other one down? Oh, it's gone. Yeah, it's gone. It's one of the best plots I've drawn, so I'm happy to leave it up there. Okay, so next I want to turn to this classic window where we look at dark matter with a mass of order the particles we know about in the standard model. Please.
This is, these estimates are not accounting for the fact that we don't know if the particle that you get would interact.
So
this is just part of the number of particles passing.
Exactly, yeah. So it has to have some interaction cross-section with us for us to turn this into a detection. And I'll say some words about that. But you can just, as a simple exercise that I just went through, determine for a given dark matter particle mass how many particles are moving through a volume. And it's just useful to have this reference here. Because if this number was 1 even for a GeV, we'd be in a lot of strife, for example, right? Because then you'd need a very large cross-section or you're just never going to see nothing. But it is encouraging that at a GeV where the dark matter is a similar mass to the standard model, a lot of particles are going through. Thanks for the question. So let's turn now to probably the only one I'll get through today, which is the classics window. So I call this the classics because this is the window that people have focused on essentially since the possibility that dark matter was a particle was considered. So a lot of effort has been put here. But I don't want to be unfair to this. I've put this plus because this is really also a very active area of research. I mean, even though it's the oldest region that we've been studying, a lot of new insights have been happening in the recent decade or so. And I'll tell you about some of these and why I still think this is a very plausible window where dark matter could exist and is just waiting to be discovered. So the boundaries of any of these are very rough, but let me call the classic window as roughly going from a keV up to about 100 TeV. And again, this is roughly the window of the masses of particle in the standard model. I'm not going down to the neutrinos here. So what are the various candidates we have here? How do you spell that? Examples. Very good. So the first one is the WIMP, or weakly interacting massive particle. And this has a mass of about a GeV to a TeV, and this is the one that has received the most attention. Then a new idea, I mean there's various possibilities in this window, is that dark matter could actually have an electric charge, just a very small one. This is something called millicharged dark matter. And this is one of the best bets we have for dark matter if it has a mass of around an MeV or mega EV. And then lastly, although we know neutrinos can't be dark matter for a reason I'll tell you about, it's possible a heavier cousin of the neutrino could be dark matter, although this possibility gets harder by the day. And this would be states we expect to have a mass of around a keV. Again, these are very rough, but this is just to give you a sense for the types of particles that people actually talk about here. Please.
Would this sterile neutrino be non-relativistic or?
Good question. And just to emphasize, although, you know, people talk about warm dark matter, and there'll be some, maybe this is what you're alluding to, there'll be some warm dark matter constraints on these sterile neutrinos. Locally, we know that the speed of dark matter is about 230 because it must obey the virial theorem. So if there were some dark matter particles that were much heavier, much faster, again, they would have flown out and they wouldn't be gravitationally bound to the, if they go high enough, they won't be gravitationally bound to the Milky Way. They'll just fly off. So we know that locally we can describe dark matter as non-relativistic.
I meant like in early in the universe.
Early in the universe? I mean, it's a function of, for these states here, they're usually born relativistic, and then they slowly cool down as the universe expands. But this is, a detailed question about each of these different mechanisms. So we don't have observational evidence saying that dark matter was relativistic or non-relativistic when it was first born. There's essentially mechanisms for both. Yep?
Have you seen really charged? Are we directly referring to a coupling with a photon?
Yes, just a very small one. So I actually won't get into this in a lot of detail. I'll tell you about why this window is very interesting, but then I think the best model that people have written down in this window and the one that people mostly study on is this Miller charge. I can give you some references to this. It's a very interesting possibility that people have started talking about recently. And the way that this could come about, for example, like why would the dark matter have some tiny, tiny charge? Well, the dark matter could be charged under some different U1 than our own, and then it only interacts through ours through some kinetic mixing. And if that kinetic mixing is very small, the dark matter looks like it has some effective Milli charge. It's sort of like how you could make this not just be hideous.
How do you give mass to those particles?
These are all very good questions, but yeah, let me point you to references. I mean, I'm just not going to do justice to these models at this stage here. Not to be dismissive, very important questions, but let me not dwell on this. Good, so what I will start out with is talking about WIMPs. So probably too much has been said about WIMPs, although I think they're still very interesting particles. As I said, these were sort of proposed in the 80s, and we still look for them 40 years later. But I still think it's very plausible that in the next few years there are WIMP candidates we might discover. Maybe I've just drunk the Kool-Aid, but that is what it is. So at this stage, I may end up skipping some of this, but I was planning to say a lot more about WIMPs in Lecture 3. We'll see how we get, but I'll definitely give you the basics of it here because it really is sort of the cornerstone of the dark matter landscape from which all the other ideas really launch out from. So for the WIMP, the mass range is roughly a GeV to 100 TeV, very roughly. And what sets this here, which if I have time I'll talk about in the next lecture, is that they have a very nice cosmology. So is this still up there? No, I've rubbed it out. But if you remember, I was looking at the various epochs of the universe. One of the things about the WIMP is it fits into this picture beautifully. And in a very minimal way, we can understand how we ended up with the amount of dark matter that we do in the universe. And it's part of that sets the boundaries of what I'm of what's the interesting mass parameter space I'm showing you here. So if this is the dark matter of the universe, how could we actually test this hypothesis? And I'll draw a diagram probably many of you have seen before, but I think it's useful nonetheless, is that we think that in order to produce this in the early universe, the dark matter had some interactions with the standard model. And at very high temperatures, we know that there was like this hot bath of the standard model particles. So the dark matter could have easily been produced out of it if it has some interactions with the standard model. And the usual picture is that there's some 2-to-2 interaction with 2 dark matter and 2 standard model. And I've not left myself enough space here. Fantastic. Good. So the first way that if such a diagram exists in terms of the interactions between dark matter and the standard model, the first way that we could look for it is up here with a collider. And the reason is if we're colliding two standard model particles together, we could produce two dark sector particles that could then fly out of our detector. But of course, this you then wouldn't see because you just have nothing flying out. And so usually, for example, what you need is you need these standard model states to produce some three-body final state. So the two dark matter and maybe one other particle. So for example, you might brem off a jet or a photon or something, and this is the broad class of searches of like mono-X searches. For example, mono-jet, mono-photon, you might have heard about. At least this is how broadly you could imagine doing this. There's an enormous amount more that goes into that. The next thing is if you turn this diagram this way, you can go with direct detection. I'll say some words about that now. What's happening in direct detection is that you have a standard model particle. The dark matter flies in. It's like this flux that we were showing here. It scatters off one of the standard model states, and then we can measure that outgoing standard model state and infer that some interaction had actually occurred. And then finally, we probably won't get to this, but what I was going to say in lecture three, I might just skip over that to get to axions, is indirect detection. And what's happening with indirect detection is we have dark matter all throughout the universe. Occasionally, two of these particles will come near each other, and this interaction says that they can annihilate and produce standard model particles, which we're very good at seeing. So if we go out and look for standard model particles emanating from regions of large dark matter density, that is also how we could detect the WIMP. I mean, the fact it's also very attackable is another reason it's such an interesting dark matter candidate, because there are many different ways that we can probe it, and it's at energy scales where we have many experiments that can test this, for instance. So I just want to say some words about direct detection. Let me give myself enough space. So why I want to talk about direct detection now is that actually direct detection itself really distinguishes the boundary between what is the WIMP and some of these newer light dark matter candidates that people are looking for. So I just want to say a few words about them. So I'm going to go through a very simple calculation of just the kinematics of one of these dark matter particles scattering off substance that we're looking for, some nuclei, for example. Usually people use xenon or something like that. Even though this is a very simple calculation, some of you may have gone through, from the result of this, we'll be able to see that there's actually some boundaries in this calculation that'll tell us that there's a parameter space where we're set for particles like a WIMP, and then there's a part of the parameter space where we're not. So that's where we're going here. Let me talk about the direct detection kinematics. Good, so the idea is we've set up some material of nuclei that we're looking for dark matter to scatter off. And so the initial state in the rest frame of that nuclei is we have this dark matter flying in, and we know it has a momentum. This is a P. That is, it's non-relativistic, so we know it's its mass times this number that's about 10 to the minus 3. And then what's going to happen, so this is before, like these pictures on the internet, this is after. What you're going to have is the nuclei is going to recoil because it's been scattered from the dark matter particle. Let's have this come up. This is the dark matter. That's nu, and that's chi. That's chi. And we'll have this outgoing at some other momentum. We'll have this outgoing at a momentum q. And we would have this outgoing at some momentum p prime. We had it coming in at some momentum p. And of course, momentum conservation says that all of these are related. So p prime is p minus q, and q is p minus p prime. So just some notation. I mean, some of you will be probably very familiar with this, but this q is usually called the momentum transfer because it's how much momentum we've transferred from the dark matter to the system we're actually trying to observe. And the other thing about this nuclei is that it's going to have an energy, which I'll call the recoil energy. And this energy at which it recoils is what we're going to have to try and capture experimentally somehow in order to observe that such a collision has taken place. So what I want to do is just compute what this recoil energy is a function of the other aspects of the kinematics here. But before I dive into that, is there any questions about the basic setup of the calculation? Good. Okay. Come across there. So firstly, we've already implemented momentum conservation in the way that we've written this here. What we haven't implemented is energy conservation. So just doing all of this in the non-relativistic limit. So this is non-relativistic, so its energy is given by p squared over 2m chi. The same is true of the outgoing state. We're imagining it hasn't gotten enormously boosted, which is going to be very accurate. And then I've just defined the energy of the other thing that's going out to be the recoil energy here. So this is matching the energy in the initial and final states. So let me expand this out here. So what you can see is that we're getting this same factor that's happening on both sides here. We've got this dot product between the incident momentum and the momentum transfer. And then we've got q squared over 2m chi. This is looks, I mean, it's not quite, but it might initially think you might think that this is the energy of the outgoing nuclei. That would be the case if it was q squared over 2mn, where that was the mass of the nuclei. Instead, we have 2m chi here. So what I can do, let me take this minus sign term to the left-hand side and just collect the other ones that are here. So if I expand out this dot product here, and what I didn't put in was, let me define the angle that the outgoing state is as theta. And so we can see the angle between p, which was in this direction here, and q is just this angle theta. That's how I've defined this. If we just work out this dot product, we have mn the reason for this is that the magnitude of this p is set by m chi v. So am I losing myself here? Good. That will cancel out the m chi in the denominator, and the magnitude of q is given by the square root of 2er mn. And then what I've put on the other side is this q squared over 2m chi and the er, which just because of the fact that there's the different mass on the denominator, I can rewrite this as over m chi, sorry, times er. So m chi over m chi is this term here, and then the other one is the one that we had the slightly different mass. So at this point, what you can do is you can square both sides, bring ER together, and then solve for what that is. And if you do that, you find the following. I promise we'll get a reasonably simple expression at the end in terms of the scattering angle over m chi plus mn squared. And we can rewrite this. This is very suggestive of the reduced mass of the system. So we rewrite this as mu, where that's the reduced mass. Where recall is it 1 over mu is equal to 1 over mn plus 1 over m chi. V squared cos theta all divided by mn. And we know roughly what V here is. If we just want to get an estimate for the parametric size of this, cos theta is some number of order 1. V we know is a number that's about 10 to the minus 3 in natural units, and 2 is gone. And so what we have is roughly 10 to the minus 6 mu squared over mn. So there's a few steps here that I was a bit quick with, but if there's any, please let me know if there's any questions about this, because what I want to do is take this result now and learn a few things about this if we take various limits of the dark matter mass. Good. If a question comes to you about this in a minute when I'm already talking on, please don't hesitate to interrupt me and ask. So the first starting point is to think, well, what if the dark matter had a mass that's much higher than the nuclei that we're scattering off? Well, then you know what happens with the reduced mass. It goes to the lightest particle that's in the state here. And you can see that the recoil energy is going to become independent of the dark matter mass. So if I go in the limit, it's going to be not one. Take the dark matter mass to be much, much heavier than the nuclei mass. I mean, you can imagine for various nuclei we might look at, they could have a mass of order 10 to 100 GeV, just how many particles we put in that nuclei, and they're all of order a GeV in mass. So this would be, if we're looking at a particle that's of, you know, 100 to TeV scale, this would be the relevant limit here. Then what you find for the recoil energy is that it's literally 10 to the minus 6 times the nuclei mass. So if this is of order a GeV, or 100 GeV or so, this is going to be of order 10 to 100 keV, is what you would expect here. So you better build a device that can see these sorts of recoil energies, or you're not going to see the sort of WIMP candidate that people were going after. Then you can ask another case from this simple expression here. What happens in the opposite limit? What if dark matter is much lighter than the nuclei mass? Well, this is a disaster, because then mu becomes m chi, and it's not decoupling. It's just getting very rapidly smaller and smaller and smaller as I go down. And so, I mean, just in particular, if I put this in, the recoil energy is going to go as m chi v all squared over mn. So unless you can see smaller and smaller energies, you're quickly going to run out of steam if you have that limit here. And so just to give you a feeling for this, if I took the xenon experiment, I can just tell you roughly what their energy threshold is. At some point, there's so little energy deposited in the system that I can't actually read it out with the technologies that we have. And the recoil energy is about 5 keV. So this is one of many instruments that have been doing this, but for the ideas that we've been searching about for a long time, they don't have a recoil energy much lower than this. And this tells you that they're very good for searching for, you know, 10 to 100 GeV plus mass particles, but they're going to run into problems as soon as the dark matter mass is less than the mass of the object that you're looking for it to scatter off. So there's more I could say about this, but given the time, let me just put this together to tell you roughly what is the sensitivity you would have for cross-sections of dark matter interacting with these states. I know this was a slightly involved calculation, but again, just to step back, what we're doing here, we've built some vat of material that we're looking for dark matter to scatter off. We know that there's a certain number of these particles flying through. You want to ask what interaction cross-section could we have between them to actually make a detection. Please.
This whole calculation shouldn't be some independence to momentum of the nuclei. It's only a function of its mass, because if it's moving faster, it's more likely to collide each other. And
so this is, so the setup to have in mind here is that I'm roughly working in the rest frame of these nuclei. Why is that a reasonable frame to be working in? Because I imagine I build some vat of xenon, is what we do, and I put it in a box, and then I'm looking for measurements in that reference frame. Is the idea. No, it's a very good point. I should have clarified this. So in our reference frame on the Earth, the nuclei is roughly at rest. I mean, some of these things are jittering around, but this is a pretty good approximation. And then, I mean, of course, you can do these. This is in the Lorentz invariant way, but then I know what speed the dark matter particle is coming in at. So roughly 10 to the minus 3 through the arguments that I said earlier on. So very good.
So is the opposite also possible, like sending a nuclei somewhere
fast and having it scatter?
Yeah.
That's actually, this is like dark matter research really encourages creative thinking, because there's ways that we can probe these things that we haven't done before. So to give you an example of where this could happen, we know that there are very energetic cosmic rays all throughout the Milky Way flying around. If there's a reasonable interaction cross-section between these very energetic cosmic rays and the dark matter, then in our reference frame, the dark matter could get upscattered to a very high velocity. And then because it's at a higher velocity, it ends up being more detectable because there's a higher recoil energy here. So this is something, I mean, I think that this possibility is largely excluded now, but actually this was an idea that kept people occupied for several years, about 5 years ago. So I think, you know, thinking in this sort of direction is exactly what some people in the community have done. Good, so let me quickly draw this plot. Thank you all for staying with me so close to 6 p.m. We're almost there. So I just want to understand some basic properties of what you see in direct detection plots. And that is, as a function of mass, what is the sort of cross-section you can probe? Yeah. So previously, when we were talking about the bullet cluster, we looked at the dark matter cross-section. Now we're looking at the dark matter nucleus cross-section. we still tend to measure it in centimeters squared instead of barns. What you find is that you have roughly an exponential drop-off up here, and you have a power law drop-off up here. So here you have the cross-section is dropping off roughly like a power law. So have a think about why that might be happening, and I'll tell you why you're getting an exponential drop-off on this side. So the peak is at about 30 GeV for xenon. And you can go through an estimate of this, but let me not. What they can probe at the moment is roughly 10 to the minus 46 centimeters squared. You might remember earlier on, we roughly benchmarked what is the cross-section you get from the bullet cluster. If you do the same exercise for this part, this dark matter going through xenon, and you ask, well, what cross-section would I need to get one scatter? If I have roughly a ton of xenon, you'll get roughly this number. So it's intuitive roughly where this is coming from, but in the, given that this is almost 6 p.m., maybe let me just leave you with that. So why this is dropping off exponentially here is that at this end, we know that the recoil energy, which has to be above some threshold, goes as m chi squared v squared of the dark matter over the nuclei mass. So as I go to lighter and lighter masses, if I need to hit this recoil energy, I need v to be higher and higher. But if I told you earlier on that I think that the velocity dispersion of dark matter is roughly 232 kilometers a second, and so it turns out that we think that it is, I mean, There's caveats to this, but it is roughly a Gaussian distribution that we see of the dark matter velocities. So if I want to ask, what is the probability of getting a larger and larger velocity? Eventually, that's going to be exponentially suppressed, the probability of that occurring. And so the cross-section that I'll be able to probe, because of the number of particles that have such a velocity, will be exponentially dropping off here. So now you've had a moment to think about it. Can anyone tell me why is the cross-section that you can probe dropping off inversely with the mass as I go to higher masses? What property that I've talked about so far drops off in this way?
I don't have the answer.
No, please.
I'm having trouble understanding why you're saying the cross-section is dropping off.
Let me let you finish. I've just realized the way the wording I've been using is violently confusing, but please go ahead. Yeah.
The area above the curve is the cross-sections that cannot be, right? That's excluded.
Exactly. And when I say dropping off, I of course mean getting larger. Yes. So, thank you. The language I was using is very, very confusing. This. The strength, why internally I think that way, the strength of the bound you can set is getting weaker and weaker and weaker. And so, but when you turn that into a cross-section, it gets larger and larger. So thank you. That's an excellent clarifying question. Yeah. Exactly. Thank you. Yeah, the flux is dropping off because the recoil energy we saw just saturates. So you just have fewer and fewer particles going through, and so therefore you can probe. Thank you. That's an excellent observation. Yeah. So it's because the flux is going as m chi to the minus one. So the last thing I want to say today is just a comment that you can see that the way that we tend to do direct detection is we build enormous vats of these inert material like xenon, because we can study them in a lot of detail, and they don't have many backgrounds. They do have some, but not many. Again, you can convert this to a barn. This is an obscenely small cross-section that we're probing here. However, the way that we've been going about this, you can see, is exponentially ineffective once you get well below order 30 GeV. So what if dark matter had quite a large cross-section but was of order a GeV or so, more accurately, maybe towards an MeV? This approach of searching for it wouldn't have seen anything so far. And maybe it could be quite strongly interacting and therefore have a large cross-section, and we just haven't seen it with these sorts of techniques. Please.
I just want to have a sense, what is the range of the x-axis?
So here, this drop, in principle, this goes arbitrarily high, up until the point where in the lifetime of the instrument the time over which the instrument is recorded, you start to run into a limit where you see no particle should have gone through. Then there should be some change in this. But this, in principle, can go all the way up to the Planck scale. You'll just get a weaker and weaker cross-section. You might eventually wonder maybe something else comes in that can set a better bound, but there's no obvious limit until there on the x-axis. On the y-axis, it'll just keep dropping off as 1 over m. On the x-axis, on the lower masses here, it starts to drop off exponentially, and I can't remember exactly, but below about a GeV, this approach is not telling you anything interesting at all. So good question. Please.
Yeah,
So in what sense is the low range mass part exponential? It's just like, you know, asymptotes, but, you know, exponential.
Eventually it will cut off. And the reason for that is that we know that particles can't be going arbitrarily fast locally because there's some escape velocity for a gravitational system. And if they're moving fast enough, eventually they won't even be bound. And if they had such a speed, they certainly wouldn't be part of the late-time structure of the Milky Way. So you can push this up until it cuts off for a given recoil energy when you put the escape velocity in here. And the escape velocity is like 550 kilometers a second. You can put that number in here and determine for, say, a xenon atom, what's the minimum mass you could probe. I'm just not doing that here. Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Good. Never makes you anyone's favorite person, but I just want to spend one or two more minutes. I know we're almost out, because I want to exploit, you know, what would it take to get down here? Just say a few words about this, and then we'll continue the dark matter landscape tomorrow. So, I mean, anyone got any ideas? What would you want to do for an experiment? What sort of ideas could you have if you wanted to probe lower masses? There's many things you could do, but there's at least two that jump out. Please.
Yeah. Lighter targets.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Good. So how could you go sub-GV, in other words? So as was exactly noted here, One approach is you need to reduce MN, in other words, and essentially stave off this transition when you start going as M chi squared. And one very simple way you can think of doing this is, well, what if instead of scattering off nuclei, you scattered off electrons, for instance? And this is something that is very actively being studied, dark matter electron scattering. There's at least one other way of doing this, but given the time, let me not wait for answers to be shouted out. The other one is you just reduce ER, okay? But in order to do this, you usually need to think of, well, what sort of properties in a material might we be able to measure at smaller energies than a keV? And just to tell you very roughly, I mean, some of the ideas you could imagine, if you think of a semiconductor, for instance, we know this has a band gap order the EV scale. Is that right? I got that right. Yeah, EV scale. So this would get you down three orders of magnitude below what the recoil energy of this is. So if you can use semiconductors or some interaction with that, this is something you could possibly exploit. Or another idea is, what if you had some a superconductor, for example? The binding energy of a Cooper pair in a superconductor is about a milli-EV. So three orders of magnitude lower again. However, I mean, with just inert xenon, we've been able to make 10-ton volumes. It's not so easy to make 10-ton volumes of superconductors, for example. So there's going to be some challenges with this. But you don't need to build a 10-ton detector, because if you get down to lower recoil energies, you're not dropping off exponentially, and you can probe lower masses here. So this is, I mean, there's many other material properties you might be able to exploit for this. And it's a huge industry in the last decade or so, thinking maybe there are ideas here that we can probe that could reach dark matter that is quite strongly interacting. We've just never been able to see it so far. I think many of these ideas are becoming mature at the moment. And I think the field's very excited about the possibility that maybe, you know, MeV scale dark matter could be discovered in the next couple of years, I think, by exploiting these types of techniques. Good. So please, there was a question before I end.
So, okay, with those materials and those methods, you get sensitive to all the regions in parameter space. But on the other hand, what happens with electrons?
Oh, wonderful question. I mean, often you're proposing systems that people haven't studied anywhere near as well as xenon, and they're not as anywhere near as clean. So inevitably, the backgrounds get much worse. But again, you're just trying to beat an exponential drop-off. So you don't need to necessarily worry about that in order to get in here. So, I mean, people are cutting, I put no scale on here so I can draw anything. But people are, you know, cutting in something like this. It can go a couple of orders of magnitude down in mass and still potentially probe some interesting dark matter candidates there. Good. So I'm happy to hang around for additional questions, although there is an event later on. Before I finish, though, just to quickly sum up, what I want to cover in the next lecture is just to finish this landscape. The last classic candidate I will cover is the sterile neutrino, and then I'll go heavy, and then I'll go light in terms of what's possible for dark matter. But because this has been such an interactive audience, which is fantastic, there's no way I'm also going to get through WIMPs and axions in the next two lectures I have. So maybe just some homework to think about. What would you prefer to hear about? And so I'll take a vote when we get to that point next lecture and then transition to one rather than the other. But I'll be very happy to share my notes or talk to anyone about the one we don't cover. Okay, thank you for your attention. Thanks.